Please turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. As was mentioned, my name is Jared. I'm the senior pastor here at Covenant Fellowship, and it's great to have you with us here, especially first-time guests who are with us. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be here with us. We're in a series called Real Church, where we are preaching through this book of the Bible, 1 Thessalonians. It's a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to a young church shortly after he, along with his apostolic team, planted this young congregation. So this is the letter that he then wrote. And today we move into chapter 2. Some of you may have heard of a man by the name of Sylvester McMonkey McBean. Some of you may have not heard of a man named Sylvester McMonkey McBean. Dr. Seuss fans know him as a character in a Dr. Seuss book that was written about the star-bellied Sneetches. And Sylvester McMonkey McBean is this conniving, dishonest, self-serving, money-hungry, fix-it-up chappy, is how he describes himself. You might know the story. Some Sneetches have stars on their bellies, other Sneetches don't have stars, but they want stars, and then into town rolls old Sylvester McMonkey McBean and says that he can fix all their problems. "My friends," he announced in a voice clear and clean, "my name is Sylvester McMonkey McBean, and I've heard of your troubles, I've heard you're unhappy, but I can fix that. I'm the fix-it-up chappy." He says he's come to help by bringing a star-on machine so that the Sneetches who don't have stars can go through the star-on machine and get a star. He really isn't there to help them at all. He's there to use them, which is why shortly after taking them through the star-on machine, he then introduces them to the star-off machine and says that the stars are no longer in style. "Follow me, my friends, and you know what I'll do? I'll make you again the best Sneetches on the beaches, and all it will cost you is $10 eaches." And so they go into the star-off machine, and then they go through the star-on machine and back through the star-off machine. And at the end of the day, then when every last cent of their money was spent, the fix-it-up chappy packed up and he went. And he laughed as he drove his car up the beach. "They never will learn. No, you can't teach a Sneetch." Sylvester McMonkey McBean didn't care about the Sneetches at all. He was a low-life, good-for-nothing crook who just wants their money. He just wants to use them. He just wants to exploit them. He just wants to take advantage of them for his own personal gain. Now, what does that have to do with 1 Thessalonians? We're going to round a corner here. What you have in the first century was, and at the time of Paul's writing, was really people who would travel as philosophers and as orators who were the first century equivalent of Sylvester McMonkey McBean, is basically what you have. And here in chapter 2, Paul is taking time to remind these believers of the real authentic nature of his ministry among them. And he's distancing himself from these other traveling people who were accused of dishonesty. And so you'll see throughout this passage as we read it here that he's saying, here's what we were, here's what we were not. You'll see that contrast throughout the passage. We were not this, but we were this. And this is the example that he set for them, that he's reminding them of. And so you'll also see throughout this passage, he's saying, you know how we did this among you. You know how we did that. You're witnesses of it. It's an expanding of chapter 1, verse 5, where he says at the end of that verse, you know what kind of men we proved to be among you for your sake. That's what this section here is, these 12 verses that we're going to read in chapter 2. It's a critical section of the letter. God has given it not just to them so that they might learn from Paul's example. God has given it to us so that we might learn from this example as well and see and know what authentic gospel ministry looks like in our own lives. So this is relevant for evangelistic ministry, it's relevant for pastoral ministry, it's relevant for the personal ministry that every believer is called to in relation to one another. So let's read beginning in chapter 2. "For you yourselves know brothers, that our coming to you was not in vain. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the midst of much conflict. For our appeal does not spring from error or impurity or any attempt to deceive. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not to please man, but to please God who tests our hearts. For we never came with words of flattery, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from people, whether from you or from others, though we could have made demands as apostles of Christ. But we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. So, being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us. For you remember, brothers, our labor and toil. We worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you while we proclaimed to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and God also, how holy and righteous and blameless was our conduct toward you believers. For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. May God bless the preaching of his word. In this text, we have a picture of real ministry. If you want your life to be used by God in the lives of others, there are a few qualities that are essential to have, qualities that are presented in this text. Each one of them relevant for us all. And it's also that our lives and our relationships will, as verse 1 of chapter 2 says, will not be in vain, will not be an empty failure, but rather that we will be used by God in the lives of others so that those around us might walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory, verse 12. So four marks of authentic gospel ministry. The first is this: courage in gospel speaking. This is why their time in Thessalonica was not in vain. We see it in verse 2. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the midst of much conflict. Shamefully treated at Philippi. That's Acts 16. Remember, they're on their second missionary journey, and immediately before they came to Thessalonica, they were in Philippi, where they were stripped and publicly beaten and falsely charged, unlawfully treated, and thrown into prison. Their outreach adventure was a complete nightmare. They walked into town. Have you seen this? How good are you tracked? They go to share the gospel, and that's what happens. They're beaten with rods, and they are thrown into prison. So when they came to Thessalonica, the very next town, and this is what he's saying, as you know, they would have told them about their time in Thessalonica, and they would have seen, no doubt, the bruises from their time in Thessalonica. Paul and Silas literally would have walked into Thessalonica with a limp, bruised from their time there in Philippi. And here's what I love, and this is the thing to catch. Coming off of that experience in Philippi, beaten and imprisoned for the gospel they proclaimed, coming off of that experience, they had boldness in God to declare the gospel in Thessalonica. They dared to speak the gospel again after that experience. So, application: how do you respond when you have a less than positive experience sharing the gospel? We have one person tell us that they're not interested in talking about the things of Christ. We have one person who gets mildly offended when we go to speak the gospel, and we say, well, that's the last time in my life I'm going to try that. And yet it's so different from the response here. Beaten with rods, thrown into prison, and they're back at it in the next town. So what do you do when you have an uncomfortable evangelism experience? You get up, right? You get up and you're back at it again, and you say, by the grace of God, a few bad experiences are not going to stand in the way of me speaking of the God who has saved me. I'm not going to allow that to affect my future efforts at evangelism and outreach. We don't take our evangelistic cues from our level of personal comfort. God calls us to courage in gospel speaking. And it is speaking this message, sharing this message of the gospel, that was the great passion of these men in Thessalonica. In verse 4, just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, there we see it again, so we speak. And they also speak in verse 8 about how they shared the gospel, and in verse 9, how they proclaimed the gospel. You see gospel repeated throughout. This is their summary of their ministry among them. They courageously and boldly spoke the gospel. Why does that require courage? It requires courage because none of us naturally like hearing and receiving the message of the gospel. The gospel is good news, understand. It is good news, and it's the greatest message that the world has ever heard. But naturally, it's not a message that people enjoy hearing, and it's therefore a message that requires boldness to speak because it's a message that says that we have all sinned against God. It's a message that says, as you see in chapter 1, verse 10, that there is wrath to come for those who have fallen short of honoring God and pleasing God with their lives as we ought, and that is a wrath that we all deserve. And it's only when you see that bad news that you can then appreciate the good news of what the gospel is, that there is this Jesus who died and rose from the dead, who delivers us from the wrath to come when we put our faith in him and rely on him alone for our salvation. We deserve the wrath of God. Christ endured that wrath in our place through his death so that when we trust in him, we might be saved and forgiven. This is the message that was the consuming passion and preoccupation of these men, and it ought to be ours as well. I want to ask you, because I know that there are likely some here who are not trusting in that message for your salvation. And so, are you living for Christ? Is he at the center of your life? Are you trusting him alone for your salvation and your only hope in life and death? Chances are, if you've never been offended by the message as they were offended in Philippi, as they were offended in Thessalonica, chances are, if you've never been offended by the gospel, you probably don't understand it, and you're probably not a Christian, because it is an inherently offensive message that doesn't speak highly of us, but speaks highly of the God who has saved us and what he has done for us in Christ. And so I would just appeal to you today that if that's where you are, to turn from your sin, that you're never beyond the reach of God's grace, and to put your faith in this Christ who died that you might be saved and accepted by God. And some of you, I know, do believe that message. This is the majority of us, and you love this salvation, and therefore the question is, do you speak it? Yes, it will take courage. Yes, it will take boldness. But do you speak it? God has given you his Spirit for this very purpose. He has given you the example of these men in this text and in Thessalonica for this very purpose. And he wants you to take comfort in knowing that he's eager to strengthen you for this work of speaking the gospel. I know that for some of us, there is the pronounced presence of fear rather than courage in gospel speaking. I know that it's difficult. I know that it's something that doesn't come easily. In fact, Paul knew that, which is why at the end of Ephesians 6, he asks people to pray for boldness as he is speaking the gospel. It is something that requires boldness. And I know for some of you, it might not even be that your physical safety is at stake, as it was with Paul and Silas, and yet you're greatly intimidated by the thought of sharing the gospel. And what I want to do is simply encourage you to follow the example that Paul set, and that is to pray for boldness. Pray for boldness in your life. Pray for boldness to speak. Boldness as it relates to your speech, to your words for Christ. I know others of you are completely turned off by the idea of ever sharing the gospel with people that you don't know, right? I'm not going to just walk up to a complete stranger that I've never met before in my life and start talking to them about the gospel. I'll feel like a salesman, you know? And it seems that the way that most people become Christians isn't through having conversations with random strangers that they don't know. And so we say, you know, okay, we're not going to, you know, twist your arm or anything, force you. You will go share the gospel with strangers. Here's the question that I would have for you. When is the last time you've done something that requires boldness in speaking the gospel? That's the question. That's the question this text forces upon us. When's the last time you've done something as it relates to your words and speaking the gospel that people would look at, as you could look at Paul and Silas, and say, that's a pretty bold thing to do. Do you see what they're doing there? That's bold. Or have you adopted an approach to evangelism, a strategy of evangelism that just fits perfectly within your own comfort zone and has entirely removed this element of courage and boldness from the evangelistic task? If so, I would question how biblical that approach to evangelism is. Real ministry involves courage in gospel speaking, and we pray that God continues to grow us in this as he is doing in our lives as a church. Second mark of authentic gospel ministry, a Godward orientation. This is one of the ironies of ministry, and when I'm using that, I'm not saying pastoral ministry. I'm talking about relating to others, seeking to make a difference in the lives of others. One of the great ironies of real ministry is that you will be the greatest good to people when you care the least about pleasing people. And to the degree that you crave their approval, you won't be of any use to them. This is especially true when it comes to evangelism. We're not trying to please people. Paul was not trying to please people. Verse 4, we speak not to please man. Not to please man. Galatians 1:10, he says, am I still trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a slave of Christ. Not to please man, but to please God. To please God who tests our hearts. He says there in verse 3, we're not trying to deceive you. We didn't come with flattery or pretext for greed. He says that there in verse 5. We're not trying to get glory for ourselves. We're not trying to gain a following for ourselves. We're not in this to get money for ourselves. And this is something that I'd want those of you who are either here with us as guests, or maybe you're someone who's here who's not a Christian, maybe you're someone who's here who's suspicious of the church. Our reason for our desire in leading this church, our desire in joining to this church, our desire in preaching the gospel and in preaching God's word and in everything that we do isn't just so we can add more people to the church and so we can get more money and so that we can be in it for our own personal cause. We're not trying to trick you into anything. We're not going to dim the lights and play soft music and try to psychologically trick you into accepting Christ or liking us anymore. We're just going to plainly speak the truth. And it's because we're not out to deceive. We're not out to gain a following for ourselves. We're looking to lead and to do all that we do as a church before the eyes of God and before the face of God. And to those of you who have had, and I know there are sadly no doubt many of us who have had bad experiences in a church in the past, or maybe bad experiences with Christian leaders in particular, what we would want you to know is that, we're sorry for the experience that you've had. It ought not be that way. It was not the way that it was with Paul and Silas when they were in Thessalonica, and that we make it our great aim to please God. We refuse to be distracted and to be sidetracked through the manipulating of people, through the self-gain that can so often be present, even in churches and in pastoral ministry. One of the things that becomes very clear in this text is that Paul relates to others with a Godward orientation. The way that he puts it in 2 Timothy 2:4 is that his desire is to please the one who has enlisted him. And you see that even though he's talking about how he related to them in this text, there is this pervasive awareness of God and desire to please God in everything that he does. Verse 2, we had boldness in God. And the message that they have is the gospel of God. And then verse 4, God is the one who approves us. God has entrusted us with the message. Therefore, God, not man, is the one we seek to please, because God is the one who tests our hearts. Do you see all that there in verse 4? And then verse 5 ends with saying, God is our witness to all of this. It is leadership. It is ministry, it is relating to others, not out of a desire to please others for our own self-promotion and self-gain, but with a desire to please God in all that we do. So are there relationships in your life in which you are more aware of pleasing that other person than you are pleasing God in how you relate to that person? Are there relationships in which your main concern is what people think of you rather than what God thinks of you? One of the marks of real ministry is that you care a lot about what others think of Christ, and you care very little about what they think of you for your own sake. It's a Godward orientation. Mark number 3. Of authentic gospel ministry, gentle affection for people. Oh, I love these verses. On more than one occasion this week, I wished that there would be the opportunity to do an entire sermon on verses 6-8, because I love these verses. They are probably the most affectionate and the most warm language in the New Testament. I know of no other verses that communicate such a depth of affection and emotional warmth as these verses. Look at the middle of verse 6. He says, we could have made demands as apostles of Christ, but we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us. We shared our lives with you. He's emphasizing their strong affections, the close relationships that they had with these people, unlike the people who come to town with only a message and then they give it and they're on their way. Paul makes a point to emphasize their approach was different. This wasn't a hit and run. As evangelists and as pastors, they gave both the message and themselves as an essential part of their mission. They didn't just preach and then retreat to the study. We were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves. Why? Because
you had become very dear to us.
There are many ways that I could summarize my experience as a pastor here at Covenant Fellowship over these past few years. But I think first and foremost in what comes to my mind is the way that these verses are true of my experience and the way that you as a church have become very dear to me. My experience has been that the more that I get to know each one of you, the more I see the fruit of the gospel at work in your lives, the more I see your faithfulness to Christ, the more I see your love and commitment to the church, the more I see your joy in the midst of suffering, your endurance, all of it has this effect of being, in the words that Paul says, desirous of you, affectionately desirous of you. In other words, it's his way of saying, we loved you so much. We loved you so much. That's why we labor as we do. That's why we share our lives with you. And this is exactly how we as a pastoral team feel about each one of you who are a part of this church. This is why we're not just completing job descriptions. We're not punching the clock. Because we have this affection for you, because we love you so much that we are willing to not only give the gospel, give you truth, but give our very lives to you, to share our lives together with you. This text really is a complete rejection of authoritarian leadership. Verse 6, though we could have made demands as apostles of Christ, though we could have wielded our authority, though we could have thrown our weight around, made demands. Do you realize who we are? We're apostles. We could have said that. We are apostles. I am Paul. We call the shots, you implement. We lead, you follow. We make the demands, you comply. They could have said that. He says, but it was nothing like that in any way. That is not how we postured ourselves. They were not domineering. They were not controlling. They were not making demands. They led not with heavy-handedness, but through their personal example and through their affection. Whenever we place greater emphasis on our title and our position than we do as our example as leaders, in any realm of leadership, you have fallen into authoritarian leadership. Anytime you have a pastor who talks a lot about their own authority, anytime you have any other leader who talks a lot about their own authority, you ought to be very cautious. I don't relate to others thinking, I'm the senior pastor, so just realize who you're talking to here because I'm the senior pastor, you're not. Now go ahead and share, and remember, I'm the senior pastor, though, and everything that you say, with this sort of awareness of my position first and foremost. No, not at all. I was thinking about this. It's not like walking around with a T-shirt with Hebrews 13:17 on it. Obey your leaders and submit to them. My picture on it. Hang a plaque on the door going into my office with 1 Thessalonians 5:12-13 on the door. Respect those who are over you in the Lord. Esteem them very highly in love. Even there in chapter 5, it's important to realize Paul isn't talking about himself. He's talking about the elders there in Thessalonica, those who are laboring among you. He's not saying, respect me. Remember, esteem me highly in love. It's not like the apostolic equivalent of an Aretha Franklin looking for a little R-E-S-P-E-C-T. It's not what he's about. No, not at all. He's calling their attention to them. And listen, this is what he leads people out of. He leads people from his example. He leads people with his affection. He speaks far more aware of his example to people and his affection for people than he does of his position over people. That's the biblical model of leadership. I ought to be far more aware. And this is how we all as pastors want to lead you. I want to be far more aware of my example to you. It's why on the ordination promises that I made back in October, the first one was basically saying that I'm a Christian. That's a good thing to have in ordination promises. The second one then was that I promised to be an example to you in godliness and in faith and in maturity. I ought to be far more aware of my example to you and my affection for you than I am of my position over you. And because we as a pastoral team are committed to pursuing this sort of vision of pastoral ministry, this gentle, humble vision for pastoral leadership, over the past few months, we've been walking through a process of having other people fill out evaluations for us. We've been having people, so many of you have done this, reading an article that Ken Sandy wrote on approachability. And it's an article that Peacemakers wrote. In fact, if you can find the article, if you just Google Peacemakers approachability assessment, it'll be the first hit and you can see it there. The reason that we've had people fill that out and get back to us with all of their thoughts on how approachable we are is because this is something that we feel strongly about. We as a pastoral team are very much open to questions and critical inquiry. We want to hear any concerns that you have regarding our leadership of the church. We are committed to responding humbly when people express disagreement with the doctrine or direction of the church. We never want people to follow our leadership with blind allegiance. We are a transparent eldership. We value your perspective, and we will repeatedly remind you of these things through our words and through our actions. One of our top goals as a pastoral team is to make you feel comfortable voicing your concerns to us and to make it easy for you to do so. And I trust that as you interact with any of the men on the pastoral team, you will encounter what the individuals in Thessalonica encountered from Paul and Silas. You will encounter their humility. You will encounter their affection for you because we recognize that we are under shepherds who have been called to care for the flock of God, which Christ bought with his blood. And if you ever don't encounter humility and gentleness and affection and approachability from us, we want to know about it. I want to know about it. We feel that strongly about it. Gentleness is the badge of Christian ministry. It's one of the qualifications. It's one of the things, really, that though we're all called to gentleness, it is one of the things that distinguishes pastors, that ought to be the distinguishing mark of pastoral ministry. 2 Timothy 2:24 and 25, and the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring evil, correcting his opponents with gentleness. With gentleness. And Paul's ministry and all of his letters affirm this priority of gentleness. And the reason he's telling them about it there is not just so they could be held to that standard, though certainly that would be a part of it, but so that others could be invited to follow that example in their relationships with one another. And this priority of gentleness then is what explains the metaphors that Paul uses in describing his ministry among them and his posture toward them in this text. You know, when he goes to think of an illustration, we were like what? What were we like among you? We were like kings among you. We were like dignitaries. We were like CEOs. No, verse 7, we were, what a picture. We were like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. Think of the love, think of the affection, think of the care, think of the gentleness of a mother with her nursing child. That's God's picture of leadership. That's pastoral ministry. That's how we as Christians are called to relate to others. And then in verse 11, he uses the image of a father with his children, another parental image revealing his affection and his care for these individual believers. Verse 11, so look at that. For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you. So there's not only public ministry, but this individual ministry as well of exhorting each one of them and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God. Our lives should display an affection for people, this gentle affection. And then the fourth and final mark, a lifestyle of holy conduct. It is another major emphasis of this entire text, their conduct and their character as they were among them. This was not peripheral to their mission there in Thessalonica. He repeatedly calls their attention to the role that their conduct played in their evangelistic ministry, in their pastoral ministry among them. And what happens at the end of this section then in verses 10 through 12 is that the emphasis shifts from being primarily their evangelistic ministry to their ministry among them as believers, although they overlap throughout the entire text dealing with their ministry. But you see verse 10 talks about it being toward them as believers. You are witnesses and God also. And this here he's describing his lifestyle, this holy conduct. How holy and righteous and blameless was our conduct toward you believers. One of the main points of this text that we take away here from 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 is that we are called to live in a way that is consistent with the message we speak. That's what they did here. There was a harmony with their lives and their message. He doesn't set their behavior and his message in contrast with each other, saying these things, you know, this one thing matters a lot, but this other, you know, doesn't matter that much. He presents both of them together as vital aspects of their witness among them. The Bible joins together the message and the character of the messenger rather than driving a wedge between them or presenting them in contrast to each other. There is this intimate relationship between the messenger and the message, and they're ultimately inseparable because our character and our conduct will inevitably have a large influence on how people perceive and respond to the gospel and will therefore have a large influence on the fruitfulness both of our evangelism and all other ministry in the church. This idea, holy, righteous, blameless conduct, is becoming increasingly rare in our day. It's becoming increasingly rare among those in roles of leadership and influence, which makes it all the more important for every one of us. You'll remember a few months ago, the prominent New York money manager, Bernard Madoff, right, pled guilty to what has been called a stunning fraud of epic proportions. Madoff was the mastermind behind a fraud that began in the 1980s, and they call it a Ponzi scheme. What this is, it's a fake, fraudulent investment operation that returns to investors their own money or money from other investors and gives it back to them, that makes it appear that you've made a profit, and then other people buy into the company as well, which means that it keeps going and going. But eventually the system collapses because the earnings are less than the payments. And what it meant for Bernard Madoff and his scandal was $64 billion, making it the largest Ponzi scheme in US history. Thousands of clients being informed, in Madoff's own words, that the entire business is, quote, just one big lie. And then just this past week, in fact, I saw on the news, there's the story unfolding, continuing to unfold in Britain regarding their members of parliament, an expenses scandal involving dozens of politicians exposed of a greedy and dishonest use of finances. What happened is that some of the members of parliament there, it seems, bought and improved properties at the expense of taxpayers and then sold them for large profits. Some of them claimed monthly payments for mortgages that had already been completely paid off. Others claimed necessities for their homes, necessities such as the clearing of a country house moat, an electrical massage chair, and having a piano tuned. This has caused outrage across Britain, and members of parliament are resigning. A headline on the story from the article just this last week, "The Collapse of Trust in Britain." What stands out to me, and what should stand out to all of us from 1 Thessalonians 2, is that Paul was different. Authentic gospel ministry is different. We are called to be different. Holy and righteous and blameless conduct. That should describe your life. This is one of the main reasons that Paul was able to say, as he does in verse 1, that their ministry was not in vain. He says that it was a success, but then he doesn't go to the numbers. He doesn't go even to the fruit of their gospel ministry among them. He goes to the nature of their conduct and their character among them. They behaved in such a way that Christ was not brought into disrepute, and there was no collapse of trust in the gospel because they were able to say, "You are witnesses, and God also. God is a witness of every area of our lives and our conduct among you, how holy and righteous and how blameless it was." Can you say that about your life? Is that what you are laboring toward and working for? I want to encourage you to not underestimate the power of a lifestyle of holy conduct toward others. There's a quote that I love. It's from the Scottish pastor Robert Murray McShane. He once said, "My people's greatest need is my personal holiness." It was this understanding that in his leadership, one of the most vital things that he could provide was his own example and his own personal holiness. If you walk in holiness, it will make all the difference in the lives of others. And God will use your example. He'll use your example as a mother, as a father, as a community group leader, as a Promised Kingdom worker, maybe a new Promised Kingdom worker. As a friend, he'll use your example, and he'll use the quiet power of a holy life to bring honor to himself. This is real ministry. This is authentic gospel ministry. Courage in speaking the gospel, a Godward orientation, gentle affection for people, and a lifestyle of holy conduct. And then verse 12 gives the reason for it all, that our lives, that your life might be used by God to help others walk in a manner worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. May God give us the grace to so live and speak and minister and carry out our responsibilities in such a way that is worthy of the God who has saved us, who has called us into his kingdom and glory. Amen.